Okay, my name is Jenny Brodsky. I'm an epidemiologist of the STD Control Branch at the California Department of Public Health. And during the past 2 years, I've been involved in the investigation, control, and documentation of a syphilis outbreak at a men's prison in California. Today, I will share our most salient findings. In mid-April of 2008, a prison healthcare provider notified the correctional liaison at our branch that they had seen an increase in the number of syphilis cases within the prison facility over the past 9 months. In April 2008, there were about 6,500 males incarcerated in this prison. The prison healthcare provider was aware of 12 cases since August of the prior year, 2007. In California, like all states in the U.S., syphilis is a notifiable disease. In California, local health jurisdictions are responsible for reporting syphilis cases to the state. We searched the state database and found that there were no cases reported from this particular prison since 1999, and no cases from this county since 2006. In terms of prison health care, there is no routine screening for STDs in California prisons. Inmates are tested at reception centers when they enter prison system, and then not tested again unless a provider suspects an STD or an inmate requests STD testing. This is a photo of the prison facility. From this aerial view, you can see that it's divided into four quads. These quads designate different residential areas where inmates are housed based on a variety of factors, including security level, gang affiliation, and physical and mental health status. This was the final case definition used for outbreak purposes. Primary, secondary, or early latent syphilis, or late syphilis with RPR titer greater than or equal to 1 to 16, and positive confirmatory test that was diagnosed between January 1st, 2007 and December 31st, 2008. We began the investigation aware of 12 cases, which were designated as original cases, and then we very actively looked for additional cases. We used standard syphilis case-finding activities, such as interviewing cases, soliciting partners and contacts, and testing and interviewing partners. Sexual contacts, both inside and outside the prison, were pursued. In addition, a number of outbreak-specific case-finding methods were used, including having inmate peer educators promote testing among inmates, review of laboratory data for positive RPR and confirmatory tests during the time period, review of the prison healthcare facility sick logs, which record all inmate medical appointments, and eventually a screening of nearly 1,000 inmates. Early evidence strongly suggested that the majority of known cases were housed in a specific residential area within the prison. So we decided to target a screening to inmates residing in that quad, which I'll refer to as Quad X. I want to note that Quad X houses many of the institution's most vulnerable inmates, including many who are HIV positive, transgender, and those diagnosed with serious mental illness. At the time of screening, this quad housed 977 inmates. Nearly 100% were offered screening and more than three quarters accepted syphilis testing. Among those who accepted, nearly all had blood drawn. Among the 738 tests performed, 21, almost 3%, had both positive RPR and TPPA tests, and 10 of these were determined to be syphilis cases that we were not previously aware of. We screened about 500 inmates for HIV and only found one case of HIV that the prison was not previously aware of. As the result of all case-finding activities, there were 66 inmates that were considered potential cases. After final case statuses were determined, there were 30 cases of infectious syphilis over a 2-year period in this prison facility. 13 cases were primary or secondary, while just over half were early latent. One case did not meet criteria for primary, secondary, or early latent, but was considered infectious, which is why he was included and referred to as a high titer case. One hallmark of syphilis epidemiology, both nationally and in California, is higher rates among African Americans compared to all other groups. In Quad X, approximately 50% of the inmates were African American. In this outbreak, however, 21 of the 30, about 70%, were African American, reflecting a familiar racial disparity. Among inmates with known HIV status, 56% were HIV positive, which is consistent with California syphilis cases overall. This is the epidemic curve of the outbreak. Dates are based on date of specimen collection. Red indicates primary and secondary cases, blue indicates early latent, and gray indicates our high titer case. The majority of cases occurred over an 8-month period between October 2007 and May 2008. The screening occurred in May 2008, and one important note on this slide is how many of the early latent cases, 9 of the 16 total, were detected by the screening. Because early latent cases are no longer symptomatic, they may not have been detected were it not for the screening. This is a graphical representation of cases housing at time of diagnosis. There are two buildings in Quad X, which I'll refer to as Building Y and Building Z. There are 3 floors in each building and 50 cells on each side. Though the cells were only designed to house one inmate, there were 2 inmates living in each cell due to prison overcrowding, which occurs in all California prisons. The bars in the middle represent a physical barrier on each floor. Throughout the day, inmates can roam freely within their side of the floor, interacting with other inmates residing in cells on their side. They can interact with inmates outside their floor during free time, work, and meals outside of the building, but have less access overall. The red squares indicate primary and secondary syphilis, while the blue circles indicate early latent or high titer cases. 87% of cases were housed for some period of time in Quad X, and 87%, not the same 87%, were living in Quad X at time of diagnosis. 13 cases were living on the same side of the same floor at time of diagnosis, and 2 of the cases were cellmates. I will now talk about 2 issues that likely facilitated this outbreak: inadequate clinical management and delayed surveillance and reporting. We looked at a number of clinical management issues. I will show delayed treatment. Prior to April 18th, before outbreak investigation, among primary and secondary cases who should have been treated presumptively on the same day as their exam, a median of 7 days passed between exam and treatment. The median was the same for early latent cases. The maximum delay for primary and secondary cases was almost 9 weeks, and for early latent cases was more than 3 weeks. After the outbreak investigation began, this measure improved somewhat to 5 days for primary and secondary cases, and there was a significant decrease in the maximum number of elapsed days, but appropriate clinical management specifies treatment the same day as exam. This outbreak also likely progressed because of inadequate surveillance and reporting. Prior to outbreak investigation, there was a median of 8 days between date of specimen collection and date of physician report to the local health jurisdiction. The major time lapse was between county report to state electronic receipt of report. There was a median of 56 days for the 17 cases that the county knew about prior to outbreak investigation. In one case, more than a year lapsed between county report and state electronic receipt of report. These measures improved somewhat after outbreak investigation. Through conversations with prison staff and interviews with cases, we gathered quite a bit of data about sexual activity at this prison. Though sexual activity between inmates is technically illegal in the prison system, both prison staff and inmates reported that it was common. Prison staff early on said that inmates referred to Quad X as a whorehouse. One inmate said, quote, "There is sex going on everywhere in the prison. You see it, but ignore it and go about your business," end quote. Factors facilitating sexual activity include the mobility that inmates have between quads and privacy within their own cells, especially at night. Many inmates reported sexual contact with their cellmates. Interviews indicated that male inmates having sex with other male inmates was common. There were no reports of sex with prison staff or coerced sex, though it's well established that both do occur in prison settings. The prison keeps a log to track conjugal visits, which we reviewed early on, thinking that inmates may have contracted syphilis from non-incarcerated partners. Review of this log indicated that there were no official conjugal visits among cases, though one case did report having sex with a female visitor in a visitation area. So there might have been sexual contact with non-inmates that the prison was not aware of. This is a sexual network diagram organized by date of case observed symptoms. Red indicates primary or secondary syphilis, and pink indicates early latent cases. A square indicates co-infection with HIV. Some early latent cases did not report symptoms, so they are over here on the far left, and some cases would not name sexual contact, so they are not linked to other cases. Among cases reporting partners, there are a few, like number 4, who appear to be at the center of the network. We were not able to determine, however, one central case or epicenter of this network. Throughout the investigation, we focused on outbreak control, including ensuring that all clinical protocols for testing and treatment of known cases were followed, treating people with known or likely contact to cases presumptively, collaborating with the inmate peer education program to promote testing and provide education to fellow inmates. We also worked extensively with the inmate peer education program to encourage participation in the mass screening that took place in mid-May 2008. We were actively involved in the investigation of this outbreak for about 9 months, and during that time we encountered a variety of challenges, including the delayed detection of cases and problems with reporting and surveillance, as detailed earlier. Also, the prison has a non-electronic data system, which made data analysis very time-consuming for us epidemiologists, and we worked with a number of non-connected data systems, including local health jurisdiction, state level, and prison data. It was also difficult to ensure that clinical and reporting improvements happened after the outbreak, given that prison healthcare providers are burdened with a number of other responsibilities, especially related to H1N1 in recent times. And we also, this issue of ensuring that improvements were happening was challenging, given that throughout the investigation, it was challenging to determine who was in charge of what and communicating effectively between different groups, since we had a variety of collaborators, including local health jurisdiction, state, local prison, and state-level prison staff. Despite the noted challenges, there were also a number of successes, including effective control of the outbreak. Though the effort was resource-intensive, to date, there have not been any new cases reported. There was excellent participation by the inmate peer education program, which likely contributed to the very high rates of participation in our screening. And the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has a fairly new public health unit that deals with many health issues with support from California Department of Public Health. This is a new relationship, and in many ways we were trailblazing as we collaborated for this outbreak investigation. These are our macro level recommendations to prevent further outbreaks and to increase sexual health in the prison. Assure all recommended clinical surveillance and reporting procedures are followed. Increase inmate STD prevention education. Explore condom availability issues, which is actually ongoing in California in a pilot program right now. Encourage sexually active inmates to request periodic STD and HIV testing, and to provide trainings to ensure that providers and peer educators have both updated and relevant sexual health education. Okay, I would like to acknowledge the many people who made this investigation successful, and I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Jenny, that's great. Ken Katz from San Diego. I'm wondering, given the movement of prisoners between quads, whether you considered mass screening at the other quads?
I'm just going to repeat the question for the recording. Dr. Katz asked if we had considered screening inmates in other quads, given that there is quite a bit of mobility between quads. We did consider it. The 12 cases that we are aware of in mid-April of 2008, of those 12, I think 11 had been housed almost exclusively in Quad X. And so at that time, we were overwhelmed with the idea of even screening 1,000. And so we decided to concentrate in that residential area. And because cases seemed to taper after the screening, we did not go on to screen in other quads, though that was something that was an option had we not diagnosed and treated a lot of cases at that point. Thanks. Yes.
My understanding, it was no screening done before 2008, right? So inmates was not screened previously. How to diagnose with A-latent syphilis if it was no screening done previously? Because A-latent syphilis needs to be diagnosed under the previous screening 6 months before. You need to know RPR. So that's my question. And how we call this outbreak if it's no previous screening was done?
Okay.
That's, I was wondering if it's never been done before. And it could be possibly some people have late-latent syphilis for a while, and it shows up in 2008, or they have a high titer because they never been treated.
Right. Okay, so the question was, if no screening was previously done, how did we diagnose early latent cases? We There's not ongoing STD screening in California prisons, but all inmates are theoretically screened when they enter one of 15 reception centers when they enter the prison system. And so a number of the inmates, we did have some dates of previous testing because they were screened at their reception center. And even given the non-electronic data system, a lot of papers somehow do make it into paper medical charts. And so we were able to review those. We also, when all cases were interviewed, they were asked for history of symptoms, and that was also used to diagnose. Yes, thank you. Bob?
Yeah, I was wondering, do you have any idea how stable a population this is? Are there a lot of prisoners coming and going, or was this basically a single population over this entire period of time?
The question was, how stable was this population? Was there a lot of prisoners in and out of the population during the time period? That's an excellent question, and that was actually one of the things that I found most surprising, is how much mobility there is. Not only were there prisoners in and out of the facility quite frequently, but there were people who were transferred between quads all the time to sort of break up gang affiliations. Somebody's cellmate was irritating someone, so they transferred someone to a completely different area. And so I actually analyzed all the housing data, and it's all non-electronic, and it's incredible. People who are there for only a year sometimes have 28 different locations, cell numbers during that time. And so I was able to use time of infectious period to figure out where they were during that time, but the answer is it was not a stable population. A lot of people come in after failing to meet parole requirements. It's hard to know. One thing we'd like to look at is how often the screening is happening at the reception centers. We don't have good data about how consistent that is. Yes, in the back, please.
Hi, great presentation. I was just wondering, how did you identify your peer educators?
Yes, great. The question was how peer educators were identified. This is something that I don't know anything about. I collaborated with the local prison staff, who I want to say were wonderful and extremely motivated to control this outbreak. They have a very successful program. It's a program that is, I think, a model that is replicated in many of the local prisons around California, state prisons, and I'm sure in other states as well. But I believe that they were all identified internally. They were already a group, and they had already been trained. We actually had our syphilis elimination coordinator go and do a little bit of updating in the training. And it was interesting, we asked them, what do you think would be most motivational for people to get testing? What kind of information should we promote to get people to agree to screen? And they said, we need some really gross photos. And we're going to put them up and let people know the consequences of not getting tested. So we were luckily able to tie into a group that was already established and doing really good work. Yes.
One more question.
Is California's prison correctional medicine contracted out, or is it run by the state?
Okay, so the question is the medical system in the California prison contracted or run by the state? The answer is, as far as I know, it's a little bit of both. So some of the staff in state prisons, and Californians should speak up if they know differently, but I believe some are contract staff, and some prisons have state staff working there. So that's one of the challenges of disseminating all of the information and recommendations.
All right, well, thank you, Jen. That was wonderful.
Thank you. I'd be happy to answer other questions later.